Welcome, everyone. This is Adrian Moore, Vice President at Reason and the host of this month's telebriefing. Today, let me cover some logistics first so you know what's going on. We have folks on the phone, and we have folks watching on MeetingBurner. In this case, we don't have slides to share. It's just going to be a conversation. But on MeetingBurner, we have a Q&A function. If you're signed into MeetingBurner and looking at your screen, you'll see in the upper left-hand corner of the MeetingBurner interface there is a Q&A button where you can type in a question. You can do that at any time during the conversation, and those will queue up. And then at the end, we'll go to questions, and I'll be able to just read those questions out to everyone, because we always have a number of people who are only on the phone and not logged into the website, and so we try to keep it all audio as much as possible. But the question function lets you ask a question as soon as it occurs to you and not have to wait till the end. For those of you only on the phone, if you have a question, you can hit *6 and follow the directions, and it'll put you in the queue to ask a question, and I can unmute you at some point and let you ask a question. And I will have to I'll have to read out your phone number, because it doesn't always give me names. Sometimes it just gives me a phone number and say that you're to go ahead and ask your question. So be ready for that. So today we have with us Damon Root with Reason Magazine and Reason.com, and who has I guess it's not fair to say you've recently written the book, but recently published. A fantastic book on the history of the Supreme Court, with a focus on the conflicts over the approach of the Supreme Court to questions of deference, questions of what should drive judicial decisions. The book is called Overruled: The Long War for the Control of the U.S. Supreme Court. And we're going to talk a little bit today with Damon about what he talked about in the book and what it means to some current issues. And I encourage you to ask questions as we go along, or if you want to save them for the end and ask them on the phone, that's fine as well. So with that, let's jump right in. Damon, the first thing I want to ask you to do is just give us sort of the elevator version of what the book is about, and in a few minutes tell us what it is you're trying to do in this book and what you cover.
Well, thanks, Adrian, and thank you all very much for joining us today on the call. I look forward to your questions and talking with you. The book is about, I call it the long war for control of the U.S. Supreme Court, and it's about a longstanding debate over the role that the courts should play in our society, in our legal system, and related to that, the role that the government should play. And it's really about a battle between two clashing visions. On the one side is the school of judicial restraint or judicial deference, which says that the courts are the least democratic branch of our government. The Supreme Court, these are unelected individuals. And because it's the least democratic branch, maybe that means that the courts should owe a special amount of deference to the democratic branches, to the elected branches of government, so to lawmakers and to the president. And when there's a constitutional question about something that a lawmaker, that Congress or the president has done, that the courts should sort of put the thumb on the scales in favor of the government. That's essentially the idea of judicial deference, that the government gets a leg up in these legal questions. And then the school of thought on the other side says, actually the Constitution is this liberty document that protects a broad range of rights from government action, from government overreach, and it is in fact the job of the courts to police the other branches of government, and in fact the courts should even act as an anti-democratic force sometimes, because there's a risk of what James Madison called the tyranny of the majority, where just because 51% of lawmakers thought a particular bill was a good idea, that doesn't mean that bill respects individual rights and comports with the Constitution. So the book is about that longstanding debate, and I followed the debate for a century and a half, and what you see is that this debate is played out repeatedly in American history. So during the Progressive and New Deal periods, it was all about, well, what is the government's role in regulating the economy, and how much power can Congress and state lawmakers and the president exercise in terms of enacting economic regulations? And you had a Supreme Court that repeatedly said, well, you know, these regulations have gone too far and have struck them down. Then in the middle of the 20th century, there were debates over civil liberties, racial segregation and desegregation, free speech, questions like that. And so once again, there was a question of, you know, is the government exercising power that's permissible under the Constitution, or is it overreach, and should the Supreme Court step in and strike those actions down? And then the final few chapters of the book look at this debate in some of the big modern controversies that we've recently seen in the last 10 years or so. So the battles over gay rights and gay marriage, eminent domain, the Kelo case I talk about, the Second Amendment, so gun rights and gun control. Should the Supreme Court be protecting the Second Amendment from gun control-minded lawmakers, or in fact, should the courts be deferring to the policy judgments that gun control-minded lawmakers make? And then finally, I have a chapter talking about the 2012 Obamacare case, where this question of the government's role in the economy and the powers that Congress wields, and then how the Supreme Court should respond to that. And if you remember John Roberts' 2012 opinion upholding Obamacare, he drew very heavily on the theories of judicial deference, and he said, mm-hmm. It is not our job to protect the people from the consequences of their political choices. So he was giving voice to this this longstanding notion of judicial deference, which is one of the other things I note in the book, is it's something that judicial deference has been favored on the right. Conservatives like it sometimes, liberals like it other times, and what we're seeing is today's libertarian legal movement is pretty consistently against it. The libertarians really want the courts to be actively policing the other branches of government because, you know, to simplify it a little bit, libertarians believe in personal and economic freedom, and you find people on the right who aren't so interested in personal freedom sometimes and people on the left who aren't so interested in economic freedom sometimes. So I guess that's a kind of an overview of the book, and then, you know, we can get into a lot more specifics.
Great. Well, so you didn't put it in so many words, but in a lot of ways you can think about the deference versus the Constitution as a liberty-protecting document, as teeing up a conflict. And I noticed a lot of the reviewers of your book said, gee, most people write about the Supreme Court in terms of the conflict between liberal and conservative justices and their views on various cases. And what you did was talk a lot more about sort of the libertarian-conservative conflict over this question, largely, but not entirely, over this question of deference. So, you know, maybe you could expand on that a little bit. I think you just hit what the big divide is, but how is that manifest?
So in the last 40 years, we've seen the rise of a conservative legal movement that was really sort of 40 years ago, legal conservatives were kind of out in the wilderness. The federal courts, the Supreme Court, law schools, law school campuses were very much hostile areas to conservatives, and conservative ideas were really not in the ascendancy. And there's been this gradual success of conservative legal thinking over the past 40 years in the Federalist Society, which is a organization, sort of an intellectual hub for lawyers and law students, has played a huge part in terms of really bringing conservative legal ideas to the forefront. And one of the driving ideas among legal conservatives has been a belief in judicial restraint and judicial deference. And Robert Bork, who Ronald Reagan, of course, you know, tried to get on the Supreme Court and has been a hugely influential figure. Bork was a major proponent of judicial deference. And in one of his books, Bork wrote, in wide areas of life, majorities are entitled to rule if they wish, simply because they are majorities. And Bork was applying that approach especially to issues of privacy and abortion. If you think about what we think of as the liberal rulings of the 60s and 70s at dealing with personal rights, such as the right to privacy. There was a case called Griswold where the state of Connecticut had banned birth control. Married couples could not obtain or use birth control. It was illegal in the state. And the Supreme Court struck that down and said that violates the right to privacy. Well, Robert Bork hated that opinion. He thought it was liberal judicial activism, and it set the Supreme Court on this course of additional sort of liberal activism on behalf of abortion rights and gay rights and things like that. So you see, this has been a very big idea among conservatives, and it makes sense. It kind of matches with some of the legal questions and the legal goals that conservatives have had over the past 40 years. Well, libertarians and conservatives are not, you know, they sometimes agree, but they also disagree on a lot of issues. And that Griswold case, the case about the state banning birth control, is a good example. Libertarian legal thinkers think that case, the outcome is basically correct. They have some problems with some of the court's ruling, or some of the court's, you know, rationale, but the outcome is correct, that this was an exercise of government power that served no legitimate health or safety function. It was purely a violation of individual rights. It was government overreach, and the court was right to strike it down. So libertarians and conservatives disagree on that, and we've seen libertarians and conservatives disagree on gay rights and on gay marriage also. And the reason is that big fundamental debate between these two competing views is being played out, or has been played out in the last 40 years, basically on the right, where there's a libertarian legal movement that's been sort of forming within the larger ranks of the conservative legal movement, and the libertarians have been pushing for a principled sort of across-the-board judicial action in defense of personal and economic rights. And so we've seen this, as I say, in the gay rights and gay marriage context, but it's also cropped up in some more surprising legal areas, such as Second Amendment litigation, where the original meaning of the 14th Amendment comes into play, and the libertarians think that the 14th Amendment empowers the courts to protect a broad range of rights from state abuse, and conservatives are a little more leery of that. They're worried that that opens the door to liberal judicial activism, and so we've seen conservatives against libertarians in some of these other cases. And so my book is the modern chapters of the book, which talk about, as I say, the big case of the last 10 years. Frequently we see libertarians, of course, against progressives in court, because those are very clearly diametrically opposed legal views. But then also that conservatives and progressives are actually on the same kind of basic side in some of these, because they both favor this sort of broad idea of judicial deference and actually want the courts to play less of a role. And it's the libertarians who are pushing for the courts to be more aggressive. And one of the big transformations on the right is that these libertarian ideas have really started to take hold. And so nowadays, I think when people think of what does it mean to be a legal conservative, the definition is partially defined by what has basically been the libertarian view for a while. And we saw that especially in the Obamacare case in 2012, where libertarian law professor named Randy Barnett, who teaches at Georgetown, he's widely seen as one of the intellectual architects of that case, and basically his ideas were widely championed by conservatives of all stripes. Well, just 7 years before, Randy Barnett had argued a similar case dealing with a similar constitutional provision, which is the Commerce Clause. So both of these cases had to do with how much power does Congress have to regulate interstate commerce, economic activity, and what counts as a permissible federal regulation. And in that earlier case, Randy Barnett was making basically the same kind of arguments about limited scope for federal power, limiting federal power, and he failed to get the votes of Justice Scalia and Justice Kennedy, and his arguments were not so persuasive among conservatives, but he's still been making this case, and plenty of other people, you know, like him have been making their case, and so we've seen that the libertarians really kind of gaining ground on the right, right, and shifting the whole terms of the debate.
Yeah, well, you know, one thing that struck me about all of this is that, and it's not just because I'm libertarian, that the libertarian argument has been, you know, both internally and externally consistent to a large extent, whereas both the progressive and the conservatives have been very opportunistic. I mean, I have a hard time finding examples of either progressive or conservative, judges or constitutional scholars who always, you know, seem to say, take the same position with regards to deference. In both cases, it seems like they're deferential you know, when it's something that suits them, and not deferential when it isn't. Is that your impression too, or is there a consistency there?
Well, I do think Robert Bork, I think you have to say he was very consistent. Bork said that that the Supreme Court that was striking down economic regulations in the Progressive era and the New Deal era, he said that Supreme Court was wrong. He said that was conservative judicial activism. He said that the liberal courts of the 60s and 70s with liberal judicial activism. So I think Bork was pretty principled and was pretty consistent. Today's liberals, there is actually a built-in inconsistency in their approach. It's something that's called footnote 4 rational basis jurisprudence. I mean, just to simplify it a little bit, the book goes into a lot of detail on this. But at the end of the New Deal, in the 1937-1938, or at the end of the Supreme Court's confrontation with the New Deal, the Supreme Court, which had been striking down FDR, some of FDR's regulations, famously changed course in 37 and 38 and said, from now on, we're going to adopt a posture of judicial deference, and we're going to be upholding these economic regulations pretty much in all cases. It's going to be overwhelming deference to economic regulations, and that is the approach that the court still has to this day, and that's one of the reasons why it's so hard, actually, to challenge some of these instances of what seems like really preposterous and unnecessary and arbitrary regulation, because the deck is actually stacked against the challengers through decades of precedent. So on the one hand, the right. modern liberal point of view says, well, that is, you know, we want total judicial deference there. But then if you look at what liberals are advocating in other realms of the law, like privacy, abortion, gay rights, things like that, I mean, then you're seeing a very aggressive use of judicial power. And what the court's rulings and the precedents have said is that, well, there's this sort of bifurcation of rights, that some rights are more important than others, essentially. And so free speech and privacy and things like that, they get something that's called strict scrutiny, which means that the courts review the government's actions, they put it under the microscope, and they very aggressively look to make sure that there's no funny business going on, that this is really a necessary regulation, it's not hurting anybody's rights, et cetera, et cetera. Something like an economic regulation, it gets what's called rational basis deference. And that is the most lenient form of judicial review imaginable. It's in practical terms, it's essentially a rubber stamp. And so that's really built in. So what seems like opportunism is basically what the New Deal legal consensus and then some decades since that have put into place. And so that's part of why it seems so preposterous. And one of the things that's been interesting in terms of the gay rights and gay marriage context is when one of these cases comes before the courts have to decide, well, you know, is the right to gay marriage, is that one of these fundamental rights that we're going to give strict scrutiny protection for, or is it one of these lesser rights that's going to get the rubber stamp, it's going to get the rational basis test? And right. this, like, really leaves liberal legal scholars kind of scrambling for a fix, because on the one hand, they're very committed to the bifurcated system because it upholds the government's ability to regulate wide parts of the economy. But on the other hand, they do want aggressive judicial action in all of these other areas, and so they kind of have to keep making exceptions. Well, we're going to have judicial deference except for here and except for here and except for here. And so one of the things that's quite coherent about the Robert Bork approach is that he really was for judicial deference sort of across the board. And one of the things that's coherent, I think, about the libertarian approach is that they you know, the libertarians say, well, you know, that liberty comes first, and so what the courts should be looking into all of these laws. Doesn't mean they strike every single one down, but they actually look into all of them, so we get rid of all of this rational basis deference stuff, and you have strict scrutiny, you know, across the board.
Right. So the 14th Amendment is a big part of the undergirding of the libertarian legal approach. You talk about that. Can you sort of boil that down and why that connects to what you were just talking about?
So the 14th Amendment, you know, it's added right after the Civil War, added to the Constitution in 1868, and it is the product of the abolitionist and anti-slavery movements and their philosophy, which centers on this, on something that they all called the right of free labor, basically the right to own the fruits of your own labor, the right to be free from government interference with you enjoying the fruits of your labor. That's something that was of paramount concern to, you know, people like Frederick Douglass, to the members of the 39th Congress, the Republicans who drafted and wrote the 14th Amendment. And so if you look at the, if you look into the history and the original meaning and the debates and all the things surrounding the 14th Amendment when it gets added to the Constitution, libertarian-style concerns with economic freedom really are at the center of it. So the libertarian legal movement really sees the 14th Amendment and its Privileges or Immunities Clause as enshrining a free labor philosophy into the Constitution and placing limits, therefore, on what state governments can do in terms of the kind of regulations that they can impose. But the Supreme Court's treatment of the 14th Amendment has been such that that aspect of its meaning has never really been given its full due. And in 1873, just a few years after the 14th Amendment first added to the Constitution, the Supreme Court essentially eviscerates that original meaning in a ruling called the Slaughterhouse Cases. And you can see today's legal libertarians are essentially have been trying to, one of their long-term goals is to overrule that decision, to overturn it, and to restore some of this original meaning to the 14th Amendment. What the courts do with the 14th Amendment now is they say that it limits what the state governments can do, and it makes the states have to follow the Bill of Rights, and they have to also obey certain other unwritten, unenumerated rights. And what the libertarian view is well, that's all true. The 14th Amendment does make the states have to obey the Bill of Rights. But it also makes the states have to respect economic liberty. And if the states are going to pass regulations that infringe on economic liberty, then the courts have a role to step in and review those and to make sure that passes muster. And that is something that the Supreme Court has done in its past. And it did it particularly during the Progressive Era and the New Deal period. And then at the end of the New Deal, as I was discussing earlier, that role for the courts to police government regulations to make sure they don't infringe on economic liberty, that's one of the things that the Supreme Court said we're not going to do anymore. And so all libertarian legal activism, in one way or another, has got as one of its goals this restoring of the original meaning of the 14th Amendment.
Okay. That's great, because that one originally puzzled me, and yeah, you think of the 14th Amendment. I think the average person thinks of the 14th Amendment in a much narrower way. So, well, jumping from that to, you know, sort of what's in the news now, but in a very similar vein, we've got this pending case in the Supreme Court, King versus Burwell, having to do with Obamacare, and it seems likely to hinge on these kinds of questions. So what can you, I don't know if I want to ask you to make a prediction, but what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, I'm not going to go too far on a limb with a prediction for that case, but I do think it's going to be close. The issue there is that the text of the Patient Protection Affordable Care Act says that people who buy health insurance from health exchanges established by the states can qualify for basically tax credits. And that is, the idea is that's how healthcare is made affordable, so-called. Well, what we've seen is that, you know, 36 states have not established healthcare exchanges, but the federal government has established them in those states in place of the state doing it. So the question is, If you're someone who has bought health insurance from an exchange established by the federal government, not by the state, do you still get to receive, do you still qualify for these tax credits? And so the question is really, what does the text mean, and how broadly or tightly should it be read to sort of simplify it? And this, one of the precedence that guides these sorts of statutory textual cases is this decision called Chevron. And Chevron, what it says is that when there is a, quote, ambiguous text, the Supreme Court or the courts should defer to the interpretation of that text that has been put forward by the agency, the regulatory agency that's charged with enforcing it. So in this case, it's the IRS basically has said, well, you know, Obamacare is this huge, complicated, you know, law. Nobody's read it. It may say, you know, exchanges established by the state. But, you know, if you sort of read it really broadly and think about the purposes of the law and the goal of the law, it actually makes more sense for it to say something like, you can get tax credits if it's from an exchange established by the state or by the federal government. So you should defer to our interpretation, the IRS interpretation of the law. So you get this sort of, there's a version of judicial deference and judicial restraint in there. You know, obviously the challengers are saying that, look, the text is actually very clear. It's not loose. It's not ambiguous. The law may be complicated, but a complicated law is not the same as an ambiguous law, and the text is actually very clear here. So there is going to be a question before the justices of, are we going to defer to the IRS, defer to the president and Congress and what they are all, at least the Democratic side of Congress, are all saying that this law means, or are we going to just actually say that the text says something else, and if the text doesn't do what you like, you know, too bad for you, Mr. President, go to Congress and fix it, but it's not our job to sort of rewrite it. And so it's a, you know, it gets really deeply into these questions of the court's role in terms of policing the other branches and also how much deference is owed to them. And I would just say, just to say one more thing about it, you know, if the classic argument for judicial deference is that the elected branches of government are entitled to a certain amount of respect from the courts, you know, the IRS is not an elected branch of government. Those are unelected bureaucrats. So it's sort of hard to see why. It's one thing to say we're going to defer to Congress, which is what John Roberts said in 2012. It's another thing to say we're going to defer to the IRS. And so I think that makes it a bit of a higher hurdle for the Obama administration to get over in this case. That's not to say that they're going to lose necessarily. Like I said, I think it's going to be close. But that makes it a little tougher for them. I don't know that so many of the justices are going to want to, like, give the IRS that deference.
Well, yeah. Has the court made, you know, that's a really interesting question that I haven't really delved into at all. Has the court made that distinction before between deference to agencies versus deference to legislative bodies?
When it's, you know, this comes up a lot in EPA cases. In fact, it comes up, you know, routinely. You know, the Clean Air Act or the Clean Water Act or something has got a bit of text that, you know, says it's going to apply to wetlands. And then the EPA has later defined through its rules, defined wetlands pretty broadly. And so then they're, you know, I'm really simplifying it. Don't quote me on that description, but, you know, then the question is sort of like, well, does the EPA rule, should we follow that? Does that supersede what Congress did? If Congress wanted, you know, wetland to cover every little puddle in somebody's, you know, yard rather than an actual navigable waterway, you know, shouldn't Congress say that? You know, so the court gets into those kind of questions, and sometimes the EPA wins those cases, and sometimes the EPA loses those cases, and it turns on the, you know, the facts a little bit and just maybe how expansive a power grab, you know, is the EPA trying to get away with. So the courts got into that before, and so not every one of these kind of statutory interpretive questions, they don't always go in the government's favor. There is, if Chevron deference is found to apply, we should apply Chevron deference, meaning we should defer to the IRS, then the government will win. But if the court says, well, it just doesn't make any sense to defer in this case for, you know, for these various reasons, then, you know, then they're in trouble.
Right. So no, that's kind of what I suspected. Not they're not really making a clear distinction between deference to agencies versus deference to legislators. Like you say, it probably turns a lot on the language of the law. You know, if the EPA or the IRS can argue, well, look, it's pretty clearly what they meant by the law. It's one thing versus when the law leaves it largely up to the agency to come up with the definitions and interpretations, then, you know, then you could ask the question, why didn't Congress define that?
Yeah, so many of those kind of cases turn on those questions. Yeah,
on those languages. Yeah. Well, another thing that struck me about this book in general was, well, first of all, it's the first book I've read about the Supreme Court since Robert Bork's, Tempting of America. At that time, part of the reason I read it back then was because I wasn't that into constitutional legal issues, but it was just it popularized this question in a big way. People were talking about questions of the Supreme Court's deference that weren't just policy wonks and legal wonks. In a way, I'm wondering what you think about the state of the cultural conversation right now. Do you think that, like the Obamacare cases and things like, and maybe even going back, to the Supreme Court's ruling on the hanging chads in Florida and that election decision, are people paying more attention maybe to the Supreme Court now than they used to, or do you think it's just blips?
I think that people are paying more attention to it now, and there's certainly a number of decisions, depending on where you fall on the political spectrum, that maybe outrage you enough. So a lot of people on the left, I really have a problem with the Citizens United case, and really have a problem with some of the recent campaign finance decisions. And so there's a lot of talk about how the Roberts Court, these are pro-business, pro-corporate conservatives, so there's a lot of interest in it, in the court critically, from that direction. But then people, libertarians are quite interested in what the court is up to on a number of issues that matter to them. Conservatives are perennially interested in the court and trying to, on issues like affirmative action and those sorts of things. So I do think that there seems to be a broad public interest in what the court's doing and the kind of decisions that it's issuing. And it may be that mostly people are outraged about the particular issue that, outrages them the most. And the other thing I would say is that I expect we're going to see quite a few retirements in the next, five years or so. And so as the presidential election starts to really kick up, we're going to hear a lot about, what kind of president do you want to replace Ruth Bader Ginsburg? What kind of president do you want to replace Anthony Kennedy or Antonin Scalia? I mean, these are justices who are late 70s, early 80s. Retirement is on the horizon for some of those individuals. And so it certainly matters, what president of the party of the president that's in the White House, and then the type of justice they may be replacing.
Right. Well, yeah, that's always percolates into those elections. So I'm going to put you on the spot now in a slightly different way and ask you about how the book has been received. What do you think have been the most substantive kudos that you've received, and what do you think have been the most meaningful criticisms of the book?
Well, I've been very fortunate to have received a lot of good reviews and some really thoughtful responses to the book from a variety of different thinkers from sort of different political positions. Michael Grieve, who is, I don't know if he would call himself a libertarian, but is someone who's on the right side of the legal spectrum. He reviewed the book for the Wall Street Journal and said some very nice things about it. And he had some substantive criticisms also. And he thought that I was making too big a deal of the differences between libertarians and conservatives. He thinks that they have much more in common, the legal libertarians and conservatives have more in common, and in fact coming more and more together. And I think that's a good criticism. I thought about that. I think my response is that, and I think the book tries to show this, that the libertarians have actually, part of why it seems like the two sides are coming together more is because the libertarians are actually having a bigger influence. And if you go to Federalist Society meetings where there's law students there, they're here. Many of their legal heroes are the libertarian law professors, not necessarily the conservative ones, or at least they're on equal footing. So I think that is partly to explain for that. But that was. It was great to have that kind of a review and something that took the book so seriously and was very thoughtful and provocative in what he had to say. So, I was really grateful for that. I gave a talk about the book at the Cato Institute in Washington, D.C., where one of the respondents who offered criticisms and comments on the book was Jeff Rosen, who is just a great legal affairs reporter and writer. He was recently legal affairs editor at the New Republic, but if some of you know, there was a mass resignation there recently, and he was one of the people who resigned from the masthead, so he's not there anymore. But he's the president of the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia also. And Jeff is a legal progressive through and through, man of the left, but is a believer. He's principled in the way that Robert Bork is principled. He believes judicial deference is the way to go, and he comes at it from a progressive point of view, but he is very consistent. So he tells liberals, look, if you want the courts to be deferential towards economic regulations, it means they have to be deferential towards some of these social regulations. So he tells liberals that they have to stop defending Roe versus Wade. So he's a very interesting thinker on these sorts of questions. And he said very nice things about the book, and he said it was superb, and it was that Damon is right on the facts. He's got the history correct, which I was very gratified to hear him say that. And then he went on to say, but you should still reject the libertarian view that he's describing because it'll be pernicious in the long run. So I thought that right. was a great response. I really I really appreciated it, and I think that my book does put that challenge to liberals as well as conservatives, which is that if you're being consistent, does that mean you have to give up some of the things that maybe you don't want to, and what does that say about your philosophy? And Jeff is someone who recognizes that and puts that question to liberals themselves, himself puts them to them also. So those have been two responses that I've been very gratified by. Another one that was a very brief but very gratifying was Senator Rand Paul just recently described the book as a must-read. He said that on Twitter and Facebook, so I was obviously very happy to hear that.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Well, great. Well, I want to let the listeners here have a chance to ask some questions. I've got several in the meeting burner queue. Just a reminder again, if you're logged in on the web to the meeting burner, you can type in a question there in the queue with the Q&A button in the upper left. If you'd like to ask a question on the phone, you can hit *6 on your phone, and it'll let me know, and I can unmute you to ask the question. So with that, let me go to the first question here. Someone asked that, what about deference to the Constitution, which means deference to the particular justice's interpretation of the Constitution, irrespective of Congress or the people? Is that a fair description of what the libertarian perspective is?
You could phrase it like that. One of the big, which I probably should have mentioned when I was talking about the debates on the right before, is the legal philosophy known as originalism, which says the Constitution should be interpreted according to its original meaning. And that's in sort of direct conflict with what's sometimes called the living Constitution, which is a view that some liberals support. And I think that conservatives and libertarians both today really are believers in originalism. But some conservatives also have this strong belief in judicial deference, and those are two views that are at odds, because if the original meaning of the Constitution says that what Congress or law or the president or whoever has done is wrong, then there's no role for judicial deference. The courts should strike it down. So I think that the libertarian approach very much is trying to put the Constitution and its meanings at the forefront. Randy Barnett, the libertarian law professor I mentioned earlier, he wrote a book, I guess about 10 years ago it came out. It's called Restoring the Lost Constitution. And it is probably the best work of originalist legal scholarship that's out there today. And he goes through various constitutional provisions and really delves into the text and history of them. And he's very upfront. He says sometimes this produces something that I as a libertarian don't like, but here's what it means, and then sometimes it does. And so I do think that the libertarian approach is very much saying that, if we're going to be deferring to anybody, it's the Constitution. So yeah, I think that could be a fair description.
Okay. the next question is that this sounds fine. I'm just trying to interpret it here. This sounds fine if the justices are right about liberty and the Constitution, but is the flip side to deference judges making the law? If they're not doing deference, the way I interpret that is, if they're not deferential, are we sure they're always going to be consistent about their interpretation of the Constitution and liberty, or should we be worried that they might just adopt a certain worldview and impose that?
Yeah, well, we should absolutely be worried about that. We have a long history of the Supreme Court doing that very thing. So there's no question that that justices on the court will issue rulings that are untethered to the Constitution. And one of the main conservative criticisms of the libertarian view is precisely that. The conservatives say, well, you know, it's all fine and good if it's, you know, if Randy Barnett is on the Supreme Court, but, you know, Randy Barnett is not on the Supreme Court, it's going to be a bunch of liberal justices, and they're just going to say, oh, well, then, you know, we have free reign to impose, a living wage and all sorts of various things like that. And what I would say is that sort of thing has happened. That's a real concern. I think what the libertarian view is arguing is that we have a constitution. It's a written text. We have to follow it. The Supreme Court has to follow it. And so the libertarians are making a principled argument for following it and saying that the courts should follow it. And I think the other aspect, and this is something I go into a fair bit in the book, is that the history, if you look at the Supreme Court throughout American history and you look at what people would agree are maybe the worst decisions that the Supreme Court has done, and then you contrast them with sometimes what people consider the best decisions, overwhelmingly the worst decisions were not examples of the Supreme Court striking down laws. Overwhelmingly they were examples of the Supreme Court deferring to the president or deferring to Congress. So you take something like Japanese internment during World War II, the Korematsu case. The Supreme Court gave the benefit of the doubt to the Roosevelt administration, and I think most people at this point can agree. I mean, I would certainly argue that that was wrong, that the court should have been more aggressive in acting as a check on that sort of behavior. There is a case called Buck versus Bell, where the Supreme Court upheld eugenics law, forced sterilization of this woman. It's a sort of notorious case. And judicial deference, in fact, the author of that decision is Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, who I write about a lot in the book, and he's one of the most important proponents of judicial deference in Supreme Court history and is cited repeatedly. John Roberts cited him in the Obamacare case. So I think you could argue that concern, I think it's a good question. I think it's a real concern. But I would also say that the risks of undue judicial pacifism actually outweigh the risks of this of the fears of judicial activism.
Great, and yeah, that's a good answer. I think the libertarian legal scholars have that systematic answer, and then you're right, just on the balance of the history of the court, you know. Which risk is greater? It certainly seems that deference to government only goes one way. It never leads to greater liberty. so it's hard to imagine we'd be worse off if the court leaned the other way. So the next question is, to a layman, it seems that both conservatives and progressives know what they would like their perfect world to be like. And then simply become as limber as possible to make the Constitution support that predetermined position rather than activism versus non-activism or deference versus non-deference, which that's the end of the question. And it really reminds me when I was reading some of the reviews of your book of the way I thought some of the reviewers looked at your choosing to take the libertarian versus conservative divide versus the more standard progressive versus conservative divide, really is I think there's an argument that really what goes on here is there's that broader
ideological divide, and that's driving these questions more than the simple question of deference. I mean, what do you think about that?
You mean the broader conservative-liberal divide driving the questions?
Yeah.
I think that, you know, one of the reasons the book is a really a historical look at this rather than just purely a modern case study is because this debate about the proper role of the courts and whether or not judicial action or judicial deference is appropriate, it comes up again and again. I'm not trying to say it's the only way to understand the Supreme Court or it's the only factor, but it's a really recurring debate, and has shaped, you know, many of the biggest legal controversies of the last century and a half. So I don't think you can understand the Supreme Court without taking that debate and how it's played out into account. But I do appreciate the, you know, I've given a few talks about the book, and I've had a few people ask versions of the question that basically is like, shouldn't the debate just be about what does the Constitution say? And if the Constitution allows it, then it's allowed, and if it's not, it's not. And, you know, and I would welcome that being the basic framework that all these debates were about. You know, I think that is ultimately the appropriate way to proceed, the way lawyers should proceed, judges, politicians, everybody. I think that is correct. But what I found in reporting on this, covering this issue, and then researching it for, you know, over many years, is that the question about the role of the court's role, is very important to lots of people, and it's been important throughout history, and it's something that repeatedly shapes big decisions. So just to go back to John Roberts and Obamacare again, you know, if you remember in that case, the primary question before the court was, does Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce, is that broad enough to allow Congress to require everybody to purchase health insurance, the individual mandate? And Roberts actually ruled with the dissenters, and he said, no, the Commerce Clause is not that big. It's not that broad. So he sided with Scalia, Kennedy, Thomas, and Alito on that. But then Roberts went on to say, however, one of the most important things we do as a court is we determine the constitutionality. That's one of the most important questions we're asked to do, is determine the constitutionality of an act of Congress. And if there is a way to interpret the law, to read the law, to avoid that constitutional question, or better yet, if the law can be read in an alternate way that makes it constitutional, it is our responsibility to read it that way. So that's how Roberts got to this idea that it's a tax, and it could be upheld as an exercise of the taxing power. So that whole approach comes directly from the philosophy of judicial deference, which is that the courts should have this more humble and deferential approach. So Roberts himself in that case said, you know what, the Constitution does not allow them to do what they're trying to do. He said that. I mean, that was like very clear. But he said the Supreme Court also has this role in the system to be deferential. And since, you know, I mean, it was funny because if you all remember Barack Obama explicitly said this is not a tax. You know, it's not. Don't call it a tax. You know, he disavowed it. The administration disavowed it. But then when they got to the court, they brought up this fallback argument about the taxing power, and said, you know, if you don't buy our Commerce Clause power, then the doctrine of judicial restraint says you should then look to our backup taxing clause power, and that's what Roberts did. And so. So that's an instance where, as much as we would like the debate just to be about the meaning of the Constitution, there's this other philosophy that just keeps rearing its head and keeps coming up of judicial deference, and that can also inform their opinions. And so my book really tried to show how that continues to happen. So it's a bit of like, you know, whether we like it or not, that's a debate that I think that we're going to keep having.
All right. Well, thanks. We're a little bit over time now, so I want to thank all of you. We conduct these every month just for Reason supporters.
as a thanks to you. And so I just want to add on to that by thanking you for your support of Reason. And I hope we'll see you in future telebriefings. We cover a lot of different topics, doing one of these each month. And you'll be getting emails about upcoming telebriefings as we plan them. Thanks very much, Damon. That was a great rundown and a great topic and a great closing. And everyone, enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you.
Thank you.